Support for the show comes from Atlassian. With a new story about AI coming out seemingly every day, it can be hard to know what it all means for you and your job. Atlassian thinks there's a lot to be excited about in the AI-powered future. Even right now, Atlassian's AI-powered software can help you boost productivity by eliminating menial tasks, generating insights, and helping you find information about projects, policies, and processes. No matter if you're a team of 2 or 2 million, or if you're around the corner or on another continent, Atlassian software keeps everyone connected and moving together as one towards shared goals. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Support for Pivot comes from ServiceNow. By now, you've probably heard about AI. You might even be sick of hearing about it. But despite all the hype, it's not always clear how AI can help your business. ServiceNow has some ideas. With their intelligent platform, they can put AI to work across your company, improving customer experiences, helping non-coders code, accelerating your IT team's productivity, and resolving HR cases faster. So, work can actually work better for everyone. So stop the hype and start putting AI to work. Go to servicenow.com/genai to see why the world works with ServiceNow.
Hi, everyone. This is Pivot from New York Magazine and the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Kara Swisher.
And I'm Scott Galloway.
How you doing today? What's going on? What's happening?
I mean, truth be told, I'm enjoying London, but I'm not loving it. There's a lot of things I miss about America, my life in America, and I'm headed back. I'm going to Miami and New York on Sunday, which I'm really excited about. There's a study. Every year they do a study on happiness, and they look at what countries are the happiest. And 7 of the 10 happiest countries in the world tend to be in Northern Europe. And you think, well, what is it? It's pretty dark up there. Like, what do they have that we don't have? And it's not what they have. It's what they don't have. And specifically, there's an absence of fear of certain things being taken away from you. And number one is that because of a social safety net, and I'm not saying it's the right way, but it's their way, and that is if your wife is diagnosed with lung cancer, it doesn't mean you're going bankrupt. And that happens to about a third or half of people who have a long-term serious illness, as it puts very serious financial strain on their family, adding to, you know, what is otherwise on its own a very bad situation. But something, one of the upsides of the UK, and I hadn't really thought about till I got here, I didn't realize how much the fear of mass shootings had weighed on me. And some of that is because I'm older and I'm a little bit neurotic. But when you have kids and you're dropping them off every day at school and you're taking them to movies and you're going to very public places and malls, which, by the way, my 12-year-old is obsessed with malls. He was looking forward to going to Dubai. When he heard that the largest mall in the world, it was like, we've got to go to Dubai. Anyways, you can't help but have these really terrible images and scenarios run through your mind. And you guess what? When you move to the UK, you don't have those images. You don't have those fears. You know why? Because it doesn't happen here.
Yeah. I mean, they've certainly had shootings, but yes.
Very few.
It doesn't happen very much. And here it's a regular daily occurrence.
Quick trivia test. The number of gun-related killings as a percentage of all homicides in the U.S., do you know what percentage of homicides are gun-related in the U.S.?
All of them.
79%. Okay, now, do you know what it is in the UK? What percentage of homicides involve a gun in the UK?
Well, they use maces there, right? They use maces. No.
It's 4%.
Yeah, small. Nobody has a gun.
4%. Think about that.
Yes, I agree. I was in California. I was near Half Moon Bay the other day, and which is where the last shooting took place. And I know all these places. And it's sickening how our country expects these. They tolerate them, and we don't do anything to stop them, especially when they have to do with children. It's depressing. You're right, 100%. But, you know, it's the way we've decided to live in this country, and it's pathetic, actually. Anyway, today, the Justice Department goes for the jugular against Google, and Facebook adds at least one new user you might have heard of. Also, we'll hear from a listener who caught her boyfriend in a lie. But first, Rupert Murdoch will not merge Fox and News Corp after all. A statement from News Corp announced that Murdoch determined combining the companies will not be optimal for shareholders. The potential deal had faced substantial investor pushback and would have required approval from a majority of investors. The Murdoch Family Trust controls about 40% of the vote at both companies. I think James Murdoch was not for it. Also, one of the people in that trust. News Corp is currently in discussion to sell its stake in Move, Inc., the realtor.com operator, and in deal likely worth more than $3 billion. We had said we did not think this was going to happen. Was it the Dominion lawsuit? Was it that it was only good for Rupert and not investors? What do you think? It was some pushback because this family has a lot of control, especially Rupert, over the company.
This is a victory for corporate governance. So while the family controls 40% of the stock, one of the things that was built into the corporate governance and shareholder rights of the non-family shareholders is that any tie-up or acquisition like this requires the approval of the majority of non-family shareholders. Had that not been the case here, I think Rupert would have had his way and these two would have retied. But basically, shareholders from both entities said, we don't see the logic here. It sounds to me like the logic was more ego or emotionally driven or for sentimental reasons. And that is News Corp. So Rupert has always had this enormous affinity and affection for newspapers. And News Corp has some iconic titles. But what you see generally in corporate America as it relates to the tension between management and shareholders, or one of them, is the following. And that is a CEO likes to conglomerate. They like to put assets together because it does a couple things. It gives them a bigger empire, and it also smooths out the volatility. And that is, okay, newspapers are down, but I can subsidize it because sports or news revenue are up, or my digital assets are up here. So CEOs love the predictability and the diversification of a conglomerate. Now, shareholders don't like it because a shareholder doesn't need you to diversify for her. She can buy stocks in different companies and doesn't need you to diversify for her and wants you, management, accountable and responsible for a very focused company. In addition, it's usually the deconglomeration or the breakup of these types of companies that are good for shareholders, because generally what you have in a conglomerate, such as, for example, News Corp, is they look at it. And when there's differing assets of differing value, investors will take the shittiest asset, the newspaper, and assign that multiple to the entire business, including Move, which is Realtor.com, which they could spin out and get a big number for. So it's the deconglomeration of these entities that will actually add shareholder value. And the investors and the shareholders realize that and say, we get a Rupert. We realize you'd rather bring your family together, maybe provide the newspapers with more steady cash flows. But this doesn't make any sense. And it's a victory for corporate governance.
Yeah, it is. And I think the Dominion lawsuit's hanging over it and everything else. And he's made a mess there. And so I suspect, you know, it's only good for Rupert. And I think a lot of investors push back, including his own son, James Murdoch, from what I understand.
His kid. His son.
Yeah. His son. So, I think he's at the end of his life. He wanted to sort of clean up the way it's going to go. I think it's a question of what happens when he inevitably dies to that company, because the family is not in agreement with each other. I think it's Lachlan versus kind of thing. That's from what I understand. And so I think he was trying to make it neater, you know, to put it all in one place. But you're right. He likes to have his whole empire. Walmart, by the way, here's some actually good news, will raise its starting wage from $12 to $14 an hour, still too low. The change takes effect next month and will up the company's average hourly wage to $17.50. Meanwhile, a sign for what's to come for the labor market, though, companies are cutting temp workers in high numbers. Employers eliminated over 110,000 temp workers in the last 5 months of 2022, including 35,000 in December. The state of temp work is often seen as an indicator of where the labor market is headed. So you're seeing a tightening up in the higher levels in the tech sector. That said, Walmart's raising rates because there's too many jobs and not enough people. Which way do you go with this? Will suddenly they have plenty of people to work at the Chipotles or the Walmarts or retail places in an area that's been sort of very good for the employee?
I mean, if you go really meta, the biggest threat, I think, to mature economies is there just aren't going to be enough young people to fill all the jobs. And that is, it's much more exciting to talk about this dystopic future where technology and AI result in destruction of jobs. But the reality is we still have more jobs than we have people pursuing jobs right now. And the market is taking wages up. But what it also kind of highlights is that minimum wage, at this point, the government is so not serious about it. And it's so ridiculous, the minimum wage in the United States is $7.25 an hour, that we should just do away with it. I think it's great that Walmart is raising their wage. I would argue it's not. It's basically supply and demand. They need to respond to the market. But I was on a Zoom call or a presentation this morning with a company I used to be on the board of, and they were talking about unions. And I think one of the easiest ways to solve a lot of the problems in the United States, whether it's depression, obesity, deaths of despair, pump more money into the economy, would simply be raising minimum wage to $25 an hour. A lot of smaller companies would go out of business, and quite frankly, I think that'd be okay. And a lot of bigger companies, it would reduce their margin. There's just no getting around. There's no free lunch. A lot of stock prices for companies ranging from McDonald's to Walmart would get hit really hard. A lot of small businesses wouldn't be able to survive with that, and it would be worth it because we are in historically strong employment. And so core and central to the American brand, I used to think it was dignity. It's not. We've decided it's a winner and loser economy. Okay, fine. But core to our economy is that Americans work. So we just need to make work more attractive. And where I piss off my colleagues on the left is that the primary construct or the vehicle we have outsourced wages to at the lower level have been unions who have been so ineffective, so disorganized, so non-aspirational in terms of their leadership and their messaging that they have done a terrible job representing middle-class workers. And I've said this once, and I'll say it again, and I'll shut up here. There needs to be one union, and it should be the federal government.
Yes. Well, we'll see about that. I doubt it's going to happen.
By the way, I was on Anderson Cooper last night talking about AI. Did you see me?
Yes, I heard. Did you know anything about it? Or were you good? Was it good?
I was actually really intimidated because AI is something I do not. He kicked off the segment by saying this introduction was written by ChatGPT.
Oh, they love to do that.
And it said, I want to welcome Professor Scott Galloway, an expert in technology and AI. And I'm like, this perfectly summarizes AI. And that is, it's remarkable and it's wrong.
Yeah.
I am not an expert in AI. And I just thought it was so ironic.
Let me just say, I hate when they do that, when they use ChatGPT to do that. It's over. Stop doing it, media. Stop writing about people writing term papers.
Everybody does it. Everyone thinks it's so hilarious.
And then it's like, it isn't. It's just terrible writing. It's bad writing. Thank you for the bad writing from the computer. Very much so. Speaking of government ineffectiveness, I don't know if you watched the hearings, the Senate Judiciary Committee with Live Nation and others ticketing companies this week, but they had to make Taylor Swift jokes all over the place. All the senators each had one. They used lyrics.
Like, we get
thing.
It. We're young.
Yeah, we get it. Oh, you hipsters. Yeah. But I have to do it myself. The hearings came after Taylor Swift ticket debacle that we all know all too well. In a rare moment of camaraderie, both sides of the aisle were united in telling Live Nation representatives, we knew you were trouble when you walked in. Senators cited estimates the company controls 70 to 80% of the concert venues in the United States. Live Nation claims it's closer to 50 to 60%. It's still a lot, Live Nation. Amy Klobuchar called the company the definition of a monopoly. She's, of course, written the book on that. The Live Nation executives apologized to Taylor Swift and her fans. You have to do that because they will kill you. And said the problem was online bots. And Live Nation said the company believes, quote, ticketing has never been more competitive. Others might disagree. It's a very popular fight, you know, fighting the ticket companies. And I do know it does strike a chord among young people particularly. But is it the right battle on the antitrust front? People certainly get it. We can't get tickets, can't get Madonna, can't get Taylor Swift, can't get this, pay too much for it. Briefly, what are your thoughts on this?
It's just interesting that the thing that's rallied the public to the concept of the importance of antitrust is Taylor Swift. And one of the most insightful people whose newsletter, I don't read a lot of newsletters, but I read his, is a gentleman named Bob Lefsetz, and he writes about the music industry. And he said, look, people have such affinity and love for Taylor Swift, but they don't ever want to hold her accountable. But the reality is, or there's a certain dimensions. The act wants all of the tickets to go on sale at the same time so they can make announcements about tickets selling out in a record amount of time. I mean, there's things the artists could do. The artists command a lot of power. And he was basically saying, look, I get it. I get that people, but nobody ever wants to hold the artist accountable.
Right.
And he was saying that everybody's got their hands dirty here, not just Ticketmaster, but look, at the end of the day, when you have a market control that controls two-thirds of the market.
If it's even 60%.
It's going to be abuse.
Yeah, abuse. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Or they aren't going to do it right, or if there's a gut down. I mean, the problem is, how do you make these things competitive? Because it's kind of difficult. You've got to know where the tickets are for sale and coordinating them. It lends itself to one company, right? That it makes it easier. And at the same time, that means you know, points of failure very quickly. Even if it's bots attacking them, they're subject to that. The one thing in life that has not been improved by the internet is buying tickets. It's still a friggin' pain in the ass to buy tickets to anything. And you never get what you want. You never get the seats you want. And you woefully overpay for the tickets. And then you have to go on these ridiculous, if you really want to go, you have to go buy them and get scalped, essentially. Even if there's now legal ways to scalp, that's what it is. And so you never feel good about buying tickets, never. You're always like, that was a lot of money. So it's kind of an interesting, and obviously, you know, it's been gamed by all these ticket brokers and things like that. And so that's the question is, well, can you stop these ticket brokers or people that are just sucking up all the tickets and getting into the hands of actual fans? And, you know, they know how to game the system.
It's good to point out that Taylor Swift has about 500 songs about guys leaving her, but no songs about oral sex. Okay. You see where I'm going with this, Kara?
No, I don't. Do not go in the Taylor era. You're going to have the Taylor fans. You think Beyonce, the Beehive, gets mad? You are now dead.
That was good. There's no way that's making the final cut.
No, it's staying in.
Our producers, our hair's on fire.
Anyway, let's get on to our first big story. Obviously, Scott, it has to be Trump back on Facebook. And I'm curious if you think it's an important story. I've been thinking hard about this because I've been on TV a lot. Meta will reinstate Donald Trump's Facebook and Instagram accounts. No surprise. We had predicted this. And in fact, that morning I said it's probably going to happen today. Meta's Nick Clegg told Axios and a number of people that Trump will be subject to new policies and guardrails. He kept using the word guardrails. Facebook has weighed the risk of harm on and off the platform as he evaluates. But they said they're watching him carefully. Does it matter? I would love to get your thoughts on whether it matters. Everybody, you know, he's obviously doing it to raise money. He needs the platform to do so. It was a big source of fundraising. But influence, I'm not so sure anymore, although fundraising is influence, I guess. What do you think?
You mean of Meta's decision to put him back on the platform?
Yeah, I mean, nobody's surprised by it.
Yeah, look, they're a for-profit company, and they have lost a lot of money. He creates a lot of rage. A lot of misinformation, has a huge fan base, huge following. That all adds up to engagement and Nissan ads and shareholder value. So they don't have an obligation to do it. I don't think it has anything to do with free speech. They also don't have an obligation. Well, I would argue that I think if they were more civic-minded, they would say, okay, you organize an insurrection, yeah, it's kind of a lifetime ban. I mean, yeah.
I think they made a mistake in the beginning by doing these weird things. They sort of panicked and did this 2-year ban and then tried to kick it to the oversight board who kicked it back to them. And then they were stuck, you know, Elon Musk, they had a permanent ban at Twitter, but then he just overrode it. He just said, forget that permanent. That was the old ownership. In this case, they set themselves up for 2 years later that they had to do something about it.
But it just comes back to the same, some of the same arguments. I see these individuals, and I won't say their name, getting a ton of attention on TikTok by sheer virtue of the fact that they're just there a lot. And it creates a certain level of veracity around just not only, I mean, okay, controversial ideas are fine, but it just, this shit is stupid. And yet we're like, oh, it's an issue because I see him everywhere on TikTok talking about the relationship between men and women. And that, anyway, and I'm saying, so, okay, a media company has a responsibility. And I would argue that the stakeholder of the Commonwealth is just well down the list here. And his power is waning, his influence is waning. I don't think it's an existential threat. The biggest outcome I can think of is that Truth Social is going to go sub $10 a share. Devin Nunes is going to go back to walnut farming or run for office again, because what on earth does Truth Social have now if Trump can go back on? I mean, where do you think he's going to spend all his time and attention? Where he has 120 million followers, or where there's, you know, basically just some kind of right, you know, very right wing people talking, yelling at each other. So, but I, you know. What are your thoughts, Kara? I don't have a lot of insight here.
I don't know. I don't know what they would have done otherwise. I think keeping him off would have attracted far too much attention from the House, especially the House Republicans, would have given them a big headache. What I think is they've been dragged back into this thing, and it feels like it's Groundhog Day for them. They're going to spend a lot of time. He's going to misbehave. He's going to call Mitch McConnell's wife a terrible Asian slur again. He's going to talk about election denial. He's going to do all the things they say they have guard guardrails not to do. And so they'll spend all their time playing whack-a-mole with this guy. That's what they're going to do. And when they shouldn't, what they've been trying to do is move away from politics, but instead they've landed themselves right back in it. I think they couldn't have kept him off given how much they've talked about that they're, you know, dedicated their to free speech. I think they kind of had to put him on in lots of ways, or they would have had to go and kick off, you know, Iranian leaders or others, right? Then they're really down an avenue they don't want to be down. And so, you know, I thought it was a little bit, Nick Clegg's a fancy guy. I thought he was being very fancy. We've put in guard that we have determined it's safe now. Like, I didn't elect you, sir. And so I don't really want you to determine whether it's safe. There was no good situation here, except to have done a permanent ban way back when, and then they wouldn't have had to deal with it. But they couldn't make that call because that's how they are. They're very equivocal. And so I don't know if it matters, though. I think he's yesterday's news in a lot of ways. That said, Donald Trump has an astonishing way of getting up. He's like Night of the Living Dead. This guy keeps getting up, zombie, and then he gets up. And this helps him raise money. And that's a good thing for him. So it's a good thing for him.
There's a new Lifetime or Bravo program about an island or this dating program where young men are paired off with their friends' mothers. I think it's called like MILF Island.
Oh, no.
I mean, it's really like, okay,
ew.
Do you really, that's the correct response.
By the way, it's according to our producers, it's MILF Manor. MILF Island was a joke on 30 Rock. So it's MILF Manor, just so you know.
There you go. That's a thing.
Which is probably better than Donald Trump on this. Okay, I want to see the link here. I want to see what link you're making, but go ahead. I'm interested.
Oh, my God. It's like, okay, you may get attention. People will tune in. But don't you have some semblance of an obligation to the broader discourse? Should you think twice before you even begin to normalize anything like this? The hand-wringing, in my view, in terms of what everything I've seen about Meta, is they're like, how can we get him back on the platform as soon as possible so we can sell more ads?
Yeah.
I don't think the executive committee where they get whatever it's called, the Facebook Oversight Board, I just don't think these people give a flying fuck about the Commonwealth. I think they will look earnest or concerned.
No, they don't. I didn't want to get lectures from very classy fella seems Nick Clegg, but I don't need lectures from him about society. It's like, just let him on and shut the fuck up. That's all I want to hear. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I mean, I'm sorry, Nick.
Fine,
that's how I feel.
Fine. Have at it.
Have at it. Good luck. I don't want to hear your thoughts. I don't want to thought. I just, although I've asked him to do an interview, although he's, of course, done an interview with everybody but me. But nonetheless, it's this sort of like, we have thought heavily about this. I just don't want them at the center of public discourse like this. But of course they are. So I don't know.
I say we put Donald Trump into the metaverse.
Let's put him in the metaverse. Yeah, that's a good idea. Then he'll disappear forever. I think it's just, a lot of it is getting tiresome. I think you have Twitter putting Musk this week, trying to continue to get attention to himself. He put Nick Fuentes back on. He reinstated the account of, he's a prominent white supremacist who'd been banned since 2021. He's the one that had dinner with Trump. He hosted a Twitter space where he denounced Jews and praised Hitler, and then he was banned again shortly after. So, you know, it's literally like the same thing over and over again, expecting it, like, it's insanity because you expect a different outcome from things that are obvious. So, I don't know.
Look, a hallmark, and this is their go-to, and there's a lot of truth to this, the hallmark of any robust democracy is that pretty much anyone can say pretty much anything about pretty much anybody. I get it. Free speech is super important. What we don't talk enough about, though, and there's not enough transparency, is that once Trump is back on the platform and starts saying racist, stupid things, or starts spreading election misinformation, do the algorithms of Facebook go, oh, this will piss people off. Let's elevate it. Because when we piss people off, they keep coming back and they arguing with each other.
Well, they say not. It feels very, very like we've been here before. They've exhausted us, Scott. That's what they've done. They've exhausted us. do whatever you want. That's what I felt.
Don't you feel that way?
Yeah, I'm like, do whatever the fuck you want, you losers. Like, just, I'm going somewhere else. I'm going, so that's what I felt like. Like, oh, literally. Like, oh, God, go ahead. Help all the dictators you want. That's what you want as your brand and your legacy.
I'm going to a Taylor Swift
concert. I'm going to a Taylor Swift concert because she at least gives me some entertainment. And at the same time, you know, like, something like Tesla, it beat estimates because it's bringing in more revenue. It's a good business. It could be, it should be focused on that and bringing EVs to the marketplace and creating a really robust and interesting economy on EVs. And he, you know, that did really well. Like, why can't he focus on that? Why can't these people focus on making things that are good for things? I don't know.
So that's an interesting segue. Tesla did report earnings yesterday and they had, it was a beat on the top line, a beat on the bottom line, record deliveries. The only two kind of concerning numbers is, as expected, their share of the EV market has dropped. And also, I think the most concerning number is their margins have declined. But the market, I mean, it's really, the power of the market is great. Now that there are more EV competitors, they had to cut prices, which probably stimulated demand. But I think in the last 12 months, to Tesla and Musk's credit, and there's no way to describe this company other than remarkable. I think they did more profit in the last 12 months, a company that wasn't profitable till just a few years ago. I think they did register more profits in the last 12 months than General Motors.
Doing great. They have better margins than most car companies. So they can cut prices a little more, but go ahead.
Yeah. But you said something that when you did your show on Musk. You said that in 50 years, he'll just be remembered for EVs. And I think you're right. Maybe SpaceX or maybe Starlink, but Tesla had a blowout quarter yesterday and the stock is up about maybe almost 10% today. It's still dramatically overvalued. I think it's going to come way back, but you got to call it what it is, and that is they had a great quarter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. I'm just saying, like, focus over there. That, you know, and they also said they'll invest more than $3 billion to expand a lithium battery plant in Nevada. Great. That sounds great. Like, I would literally get the fuck off Twitter. Stop making, like, a mess over there. Take it bankrupt, whatever. I don't care. Stop platforming Nazis and focus on this. You know, it's just you sit there and you're like, ay, 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 ay.
Yeah, this has been, I don't know if you saw, but there was new information that said that Twitter's revenue, and we had
70%.
Said this, and then we did back of the envelope math and said, well, if your top 50 advertisers have gone to zero, that probably means the other 50 have cut it in half. So we kind of ballparked 70%. And then a week ago, they said it was 40%. And it was like, no, it wasn't. That was year on year, bad data, you know, the same day. But keep in mind, that means his revenues now are just barely covering his interest payments. And now there's word that he's trying to raise money to go buy back some of that debt. And what I love about this story, and the mother of all, we think investors are really stupid. They were trying to raise money at the initial valuation that he raised money for way back when at $45 billion. This is the equivalent. of buying a used car or buying a car in the height of COVID when car prices just surged. You went out and you bought a Toyota Corolla for $40,000. And then you went and you crashed the thing and then tried to sell it for $40,000 again.
He'll get the money. He'll get the money. 100% the Saudis. It's got to be some shitty dictator somewhere. I'll give him money, you know. He'll get the money.
I don't doubt he can find the money. It'll be on what terms. And also, now that his stock is up, I wouldn't be surprised if he sells more stock and tries to buy it back himself.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got to get rid of that debt. I was looking at the terms of it. I was reading some more detailed things, and it's pretty bad. It keeps going up. It keeps getting real problematic as that particular tranche he's trying to get rid of. The other is at, I think, 4%, 6%, whatever. But this other one just keeps exploding, essentially. He should buy it back. And so the question is, does he want to put more? You know where he should put his money into? Tesla. You got a lot of competitors. You're doing some cool shit. Put your money over in Tesla. All his money should be in Tesla and the rockets. That's where it should stay. But no, no, no. He has to tweet and irritate people and et cetera. Anyway, all right, Scott, let's go on a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about the DOJ's threat to Google and take a listener question.
Fox Creative.
This is advertiser content from Atlassian.
One of our customers who produces pizza at a very large scale all across the world, believe it or not, they use AI to review the quality of the pizzas that are created. That goes through a workflow that scans the images of the pizzas and makes sure they visually look like what they should. So it's pretty cool.
That's Sharif Mansour, Atlassian's head of AI. Sharif thinks there's a lot for companies to be excited about on the AI-generated horizon, spanning everything from making pizza to producing podcasts like the one you're listening to now.
There'll be far more jobs created on the other side of this revolution.
Instead of a world of less, Sharif envisions an AI-powered world of more.
In everyone's day job, they're moving from doing the thing to often being an architect of the thing. It unleashes the potential of every human. And I think we can go from a world where few people have access to a high level of intelligence to a lot more people having access to this information. AI is really giving everyone on the planet more resources to do great things. And I'm very optimistic about that opportunity that lies ahead.
Transform teamwork with the power of AI-human collaboration. Start using Atlassian Intelligence for your Atlassian products like Jira and Confluence now. Learn more at Atlassian.com. That's AtlAssian.com.
This week on The Gray Area, writer Derek Thompson makes his case that everything has become a cult. Well, almost everything. Is Taylor Swift the closest thing we have to a mass cult today?
No, I think she's the closest thing we have to Christianity. It's me.
Find out if you're in a cult this week on The Gray Area, wherever you get your podcasts.
The DOJ is suing Google over its alleged dominance in online advertising tech. The suit claims that Google buys up ad tech companies and keeps out competitors. It also says Google harms publishers by limiting their ability to monetize content. The DOJ wants Google to divest part of its ad business, including its ad server, DoubleClick, and its ad exchange, AdX. The suit comes shortly after Jonathan Cantor was cleared to work on Google cases. He's moved pretty quickly. Cantor is the department's assistant AG for antitrust. He was previously blocked from overseeing Google cases while the department reviewed a complaint from Alphabet. He's also a lawyer before this. So this is not a surprise. It's definitely a problem for Google to deal with. Google, of course, says that it this is not a problem and there's lots of competition, et cetera, et cetera. But it's its business model. It controls 29% of online advertising. Meta has 20. I guess the rest of it's Amazon and some others. But this is on the tools that control the market. And Google really owns the whole stack from soup to nuts. Everybody has known that. But it is their whole business. It's 80% of their revenue. What thinks you?
Yeah, look, we've been saying this forever. It's just weird to have you're both running the auction, controlling the supply and the demand. There's very little transparency into the price. And at the same time, their defense will be, well, why do you think we've grown so much? People do have options and they continue to choose us. So clearly it's working. But it just, you know, if you have an economist explain it to you, it's just an example of a perfect example of, you know, people shouldn't control both the demand and the supply side of the market and be the market maker. So it feels like ground zero for antitrust and breakup. The question is, are they just outgunned and overwhelmed by lawyers and lobbyists and money? But any economist worth their salt looks at Google around the online ad market and goes, every antitrust law invented was supposed to prevent this.
Yeah, I just don't know what took so long. I mean, it's interesting because digital advertising might be on a downward slope. I mean, app tracking transparency from Apple has hit it. People not responding to it. It could be that this is a business that is already, the market is already taken care of, but they still dominate, like, especially on the entire stack of things, whether it's small businesses that want to buy advertising. The Google Ads Network has an 80% share. This is according to the DOJ, and DoubleClick for publishers has 90% share. They really do run everything. And what happens if they make them divest DoubleClick and other ad tech, the tools, versus just selling advertising?
That would be really interesting. Those companies, what you would think would happen, at least in theory, those companies get sold. Google shareholders take a hit. But the the cost of online advertising, the cost for advertisers goes slowly but surely goes down because now you have more suppliers competing for ad dollars.
Yeah, that's really pretty much it. And what do you think the chances of that happening? This is a long drawn out fight. And it feels like yesterday's fight. This has been going on. They've dominated advertising for years. And the EU has looked into this and has passed laws. And this feels so late. It feels so late, but maybe it isn't.
I think we're just exhausted and we've heard about it so long. I mean, big tech has just done a great job of delay and obfuscation and exhausting everybody. And kind of this Kremlin style communication of flooding the zone with just all sorts of arguments and information, some of it accurate, some not, hiring very thoughtful, likable people, giving money not only to Republicans, but to Democrats. And it's the ultimate deal. It's the best bargain for an elected official whose reelection is largely based on two things: incumbency and how much money they raise. It's the perfect or an irresistible agreement. I'm going to give you money. We're like-minded. We really support your thoughts, views on the economy in America. And they're like, okay, well, what do I have to do? Let's be honest. What do I have to do in exchange for you giving me this money? And the answer is nothing. When Senator Klobuchar proposes antitrust, start asking just a lot of very earnest, thoughtful questions about your concerns, about could this in fact make it the economy less competitive, and just let it sit in committee forever. I mean, this feels like it's not even Groundhog Day, it's Groundhog Decade.
I feel like I've been talking about this. I found a story I wrote 15 years ago about this, saying Google shouldn't have this dominance. I mean, and why isn't the FTC or the Justice Department acting? It does feel like the market will eventually take care of it. Like Apple's getting into it, Amazon. It's all big companies, of course. It's not, you don't see a lot of innovation in ad tech. Why would there be?
I think that's their argument. Because the argument, at the end of the day, everything everywhere ends. And that's one of their arguments is, these companies too will be disruptive. It's like, yeah, but between now and then, we should have a more robust competitive market, more shareholder value, more jobs. But it is, I like the term, it's Groundhog Decade.
Very much so. Anyway, let's pivot to a listener question.
You've got, I can't believe I'm going to be a mailman. You've got
mail.
Let's listen to it.
Hi, Carol and Scott. My name is Annie, and I'm a new listener calling on behalf of a longtime listener. My boyfriend, Tyler, has been listening to all things Kara Swisher and Scott Galloway since way before we started dating. I actually used to think he was incredibly informed and well-read until I also started listening to the Pivot podcast and realized he was actually just copying all of his information from the two of you. That being said, it is about to be Tyler's 30th birthday in February. To celebrate his arrival into a new decade, I would love for him to have some insight from his two favorite podcasters. If you were to turn 30 again, what would you have done the same? What would you have done differently? And what is a habit you would have liked to have started or stopped in your 30th year? And Kara, as a longtime DC resident, I'm very sad to have heard about your Tesla run-in with your Kia. That being said, it absolutely would have happened in DuPont Circle. All the best to the both of you. Thanks.
Wow. That's a question, huh? Interesting. Happy birthday, Tyler.
Would you do differently or the same at 30? Yeah, happy birthday, Tyler.
Yeah, happy birthday. And by the way, it's Evan Engel's birthday, too. So happy birthday, Engel. He's a producer on Pivot. Happy birthday to him, too. 30. I got to say, nothing different. I would have had, I would have been pregnant again. I would have gotten pregnant again. I love being pregnant. I wish I hadn't get pregnant until I was 38, though. I don't know. What would you have done differently? I would have been more risk-taking. I'm pretty risk-taking. I would have been even more so. What about you?
I would have done two things, two kind of regrets. Did a lot, took advantage of a great economy, started businesses, really enjoyed myself, had good relationships, with my mom. I had a really, really good relationships with women in my life. A lot of good things, a lot of blessings. The two things, big things I regret are, one is the same as yours. As I get older, I really wish I had a little girl. I wish I'd had a third kid. And that probably would have meant starting earlier. And, as I get older, it's weird. I never wanted kids. And I was the one in the relationship that decided to stop at two. And I'm just, Every time I see a little girl now, I think, God, I would just love to have a little girl. Anyways, I wish I'd had more kids. Specifically, I wish I'd had a daughter. And then the other thing, just on a bigger level, and I, you know, I wish I'd been kinder. I wasn't a bad person. I wasn't mean, but with just a little bit of effort, I could have made a lot of people's lives much nicer by just being kinder. And I was so caught up in my own shit. I was so ambitious. I was so thinking about every decision was, how do I make me more fucking awesome all the time? And I was never mean. I never went out of my way to be mean to anybody. But with just a little bit more effort with my employees, with strangers, with people in my life, I just could have been kinder. And you realize it doesn't take a lot to really make people's lives nicer. I mean, if you're in a position of economic security, or people are impressed by you, or people love you, it just doesn't take a lot of effort.
Yeah, I would agree. You know,
to make their day, right?
I would agree. I think
and
that's...
I didn't, you know what? The reality is, I didn't do a lot of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with you. I would agree with you. I'm more with the risk taking. Besides getting pregnant again, I really wish I had gotten pregnant again. I liked it. It was interesting. I loved it. But I did have more kids. So I did do that. And I was happy that I did that. Because at the time, I remember right after I couldn't anymore, I'm like, oh, shoot, I missed that one. But I didn't, as it turns out. And I'm glad I did that. I got to say, I don't have that many regrets. I don't. I'm trying to think. Just more risk taking, even more so. More cowbell, more swish. Sure. That's what I would have done. More like, could see you later, more changing jobs, more taking risks, that kind of stuff, I think, probably. Saying yes to a lot more things that I was worried about.
But my advice to this kid, this 30-year-old, I mean, look at this. He has a partner calling a show that he obviously likes to try and surprise and delight him, right?
Yeah.
You know, take stock of your blessings.
Be nice to
Be
Annie,
appreciative.
Tyler. Ask her to really, marry. Are you married? Are you married?
When you were 30, did you have the presence I didn't to just realize how fucking blessed you are?
Yes.
I didn't.
Yes.
I thought it was all me. I thought everything good that happened to me was a function of just how awesome I was. I never took the time to really stop and think, Jesus Christ, am I lucky? And you get that perspective as you get older. And the younger you get it, I think the more rewarding a life you can lead, because it just gives you a sense of satisfaction and reward.
I'll give Tyler one more piece of advice that I think I work for me. Think about the fact that you're not going to be here in 100 years. Just really do. It really does put a lot of things
100%.
In perspective. You know, 30, right now, 30, how old? He could go to 70 years, you know, 70 or more years. Finite. Everything's finite. So realize that, and realize it every day of your life. And then I think that's what you would do. And don't crib off of us and pretend it's your intelligence. That's not cool. But Annie, I'm glad you're on to him.
That's
most people
right.
do that. But otherwise, happy birthday, Tyler. And Annie, thank you so much about the Kia. It was a tragedy. It was a tragedy. Of course, it was a Tesla that did it. Anyway, if you've got a question of your own that you'd like answered, send it our way. Go to nymag.com/pivot to submit a question for the show, or call 855-51-PIVOT. Wait, one quick question, Scott, before we get to predictions. What would your daughter's name have been?
We didn't get to the naming thing.
No?
I don't know.
Nothing? You're in Britain.
I don't know. Anne? What are you saying?
No. Oh, God, you're in Britain. Like Drusilla. They have so many good names. Or Prunella or something like that. You live in Britain.
Yeah, I never got to the naming part. We named our sons very Scottish names. Alec is Scottish. Nolan, because Nolan Ryan was my favorite athlete growing up. But the nice part is his mother, I tell the story in my class, and that is, I met my oldest's mother at the pool at the Raleigh Hotel. And Kara, I don't know how you and Amanda met, or you guys on blind date, but it was the middle of the day at the pool at the Raleigh, in the middle of the a Sunday. And I said to myself, I saw her, and I said, I'm going to speak to her before I leave. And I promised myself I would speak to her. And I sat there for a couple hours, and to open a conversation with a stranger who's sitting with another woman and another guy wearing nothing by the pool without the assistance of alcohol, that is not easy.
What did you do? What'd you
say? And I said, I'm not leaving until I spoke to her.
What'd you say?
I just went up and said, hey, where are you guys from? Anyways, but the good part is it was at the Raleigh Hotel, and my oldest son's middle name is Raleigh.
Oh, nice. Oh, nice.
What I tell young people is nothing really wonderful will happen to you unless you take an uncomfortable risk.
Oh, nice. Well, that's our message.
That's our message.
That you are 100% correct. And by the way, until I had a daughter, I called Louie Louise a lot, and he didn't mind. Anyway, Scott, one more quick break. We'll be back for predictions.
Hey, everyone. This is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the streaming wars. And there's a new docuspecial on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
Okay, Scott, let's hear a prediction.
Regardless of whether AI, whether the performance matches the promise, and we're already into kind of, I don't want to call it peak hype cycle, but we're into the hype cycle of AI already. 0 to 1 million users in 5 days versus 75 for Instagram, 150 for Spotify. But we're going to see the investment that Microsoft made as one of the savviest investments in corporate history. Because even if it doesn't live up to the potential, the market share that Bing is going to get in the 90 days after it launches like a ChatGPT inspired or driven product. Because if you think about search, I spent some time on Bing last night. If you think about AI, it's supposed to be a predictions engine. And Google, at the end of the day, search is supposed to predict what would be the best answer. And what has happened to Google, Google has no shortage of AI, but what has happened is, to Google is that the economic incentives have turned it into sort of a cesspool. And that is, it used to take you to the best answer. Now it takes you to the place they can further monetize. And if you type in best resorts in Thailand for families, it'll give you 15 links, some of which that people are paying to be there. And you kind of sort through stuff and you have to still come up with your own answer. And Bing, at least from a perception standpoint, should they incorporate ChatGPT, which they will say, when you use Bing, we're not going to give you 15 shitty answers. We're going to give you the one right one. And it'll be an answer that'll be something along the lines of, the three best travel resorts in Thailand, or the three best resorts for families in Thailand, are X, Y, and Z. And even if it's not, even if there's no real there, I think the perception, I think Bing is about to get so much trial. And the idea and the perception that Microsoft could be a new dominant force again in search is going to take a $1.5 trillion market cap company. If it just takes it up 10%, they've got a 15x return on the $10 billion they put into OpenAI, excuse me. So in sum, in 6 or 12 months, we're going to look back on Microsoft and Satya Nadella. Keep in mind, he put $1 billion into OpenAI in 2019 when no one was talking about it. We're going to see this as one of the savviest corporate moves in a long, long time. This is a great move by Microsoft.
Great. Well, there you have it. That, I think that's a good one. I think you're right. But I do think there's some overhyping going on here. We'll see where it goes. I do think there's a lot more going on at the Googles and Amazons and Facebooks of the world than they're letting on. I think, though, that Microsoft's made a smart move here in terms of getting market share and interest and focus on them, sort of first mover advantage. But I don't count Google out of this one. But I agree. I think they've let other people take their market share.
It comes back again. You brought up the innovator's dilemma last week, and that is, it is just really hard to attack the golden goose. They have this $150 billion cash volcano called search, and unfortunately involves giving you a lot of marginal links to marginal answers. And basically the promise of a prediction engine, which is what AI promises, is to say, no, we're going to give you one answer and that's it. And it totally flies in the face of their business model. The whole point, the way Google monetizes search, is by giving you a couple hundred links back.
It used to be more
instead
delightful.
Of saying, this is the answer.
It used to be more delightful for some reason and useful. But you're right. You can't.
It's gotten
it's not
worse.
Helpful.
Despite the technology getting better at Google, Google has no shortage of AI. What Google has is an incentive structure.
No. They have deep minds. They've got to be creative and figure out creative and delightful ways to use their products. And they're not delightful anymore. And that's why people are responding to chat. It's interesting and it's interesting. That's all it is. And so I think there's new ways to search. And I remember years ago saying, search is so, we'll look back on typing words into a box and think how Neanderthal Neanderthal of us. Because what a silly way. There should be so many other ways to search that aren't, that have a lot more to do with us. And I don't know. I just always thought it was so, it was not the way it was going to go. Anyway, good prediction, Scott Galloway. That's the show. We'll be back on Tuesday with more Pivot. Scott, read us out.
Today's show was produced by Lara Naiman, Evan Engel, and Taylor Griffin. Ernie Intertot engineered this episode. Thanks also to Drew Burrows and Emil Silverio. Make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening to Pivot from New York Magazine and Vox Media. We'll be back next week for another breakdown of all things tech and business. Recognize the finite nature of life, be kind, and have daughters. Support for the show comes from Atlassian. Whether you're exploring space, making pizza, or producing a podcast like this one here, chances are your team is marching into the AI-generated horizon. Atlassian Intelligence is unleashing a new era of teamwork. You can use Atlassian's AI-powered products for everything from brainstorming ideas to finding information to summarizing huge documents, all by using normal, everyday language. Atlassian AI-powered software like Jira and Confluence help teams accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how you can transform teamwork with the power of AI at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.